Welcome to The Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Stephen King, and if he is, in fact, the master of horror. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson, and joining me today is Troy Heinrichs.
What's up, everybody? This episode is not for the princesses of the land. This is for the people that are into werewolves and fear-eating clowns and things that go bump in the night or in a different dimension, potentially.
Potentially. And as you may know, a hurricane's kind of causing a ruckus currently when we're recording this. So rather than cancel this week's episode, as we're out of two of our normal hosts and John and Amanda for different reasons, we decided to have a discussion we've been meaning to have about Mr. Stephen King. And I feel like it's very timely since Salem's Lot just hit Max finally after being delayed. And then you can stick around at the end. We're going to have our Stephen King movie battle royale, which is actually from a previous episode, but it's still fun. It's still a fun listen.
And it's whether you've heard it or classics. Not. I mean, even if we were to do that battle royale today, I don't think it would change.
It would not. And it wasn't that long ago, so I don't think it would change. There hasn't been anything to really combat how it played out, which you'll have to listen to if you haven't heard it before. So remember, this isn't a normal episode. This is kind of off book, if you will, thanks to current conditions. And also keep fingers crossed for John. He's unfortunately right in the path of one of those.
So second time in like a month.
Yeah. Yeah. He's having a rough go of it. So everybody keep in your thoughts, if you would. Because I don't want to. I mean, that's a lot of work on my part. So if you could do it for me, the heavy lifting, that would be great.
Yeah, I was like, I have enough brain power to get through the episode, and that's about it.
So we're going to start like this first part before we get to kind of the classic battle royale. We want to talk just like Stephen King. I mean, really kind of two old friends having a conversation we've never really had, I don't think.
In a decade, we've never really actually sat down and talked about.
No.
Wow, really?
Because he's very, very, he's very influential in both of our lives for different reasons. I would say I'm more of the fan of the horror king, and you're more of the more
cerebral, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, the more intellectual, science fictiony, Dark Tower-ish,
yeah, kind of time travel king. That kind of stuff. Yeah.
And I like dogs that bite and cars that bite,
vampires that bite.
Yeah, exactly.
Just not Pet Cemetery with that damn cat.
Do you? Oh man, I just hit a deer today. And that's what Gage felt like. So, I mean, I feel like it's full circle. Sorry. I feel bad for that deer. Not so much for Gage because he was a little bastard when he came back. So, all right. When did you first become a fan? Like, do you remember when you first became a Stephen King fan? Do you remember anything?
Yeah. I mean, it had to have been, you know, in that ripe old age of we're going to watch whatever R-rated movies we want between, you know, 12 and 15 years old because, you know, we had cable and we could figure that out and descramble stuff and all that back in the day. So,
sure.
And we didn't even really need to do that for the It miniseries with Tim Curry. That was the first King thing I think I watched when I was about 14.
Did you like it at the time?
You know, at the time it was, I mean, you're young, right? So your brain is still developing. You're trying to figure out what the hell are you watching and why is there a clown and why is there a giant roach monster? And
mine still is, honestly.
You know, the asthma thing? Is there really, you know, is medicine in there or is it just water and it's a placebo and all this other stuff? And so, I mean, I was scared shitless. I would never go by a sewer drain for the rest of my life. Anytime I saw a red balloon, I was like, no, I'll take the blue one. Thanks. It imprinted for sure. You know, that clowns are bad.
So you're started with that miniseries.
I think so. I think that's the earliest memory I have. And then of course, over time you get to see things like Carrie and Cujo and Salem's Lot and kind of some of those classics after you kind of understood what Stephen King was all about, because now you're into the 90s where you're watching things like, you know, Shawshank and the Stand miniseries and things of that nature that were coming out at the time.
Yeah. What's funny, you know, my mom, I've talked about this in the podcast before. My mom famously got me into Alfred Hitchcock. Everything I love, my mom got me into. It's just a fact. And she read Stephen King like it was like he's going on a style. There's not a single book or novella that he's written that she hasn't read, right? Every one of them.
I feel sad for her.
She loves them all. And even Richard Bachman, is that the pseudonym, is Richard Bachman, right?
Yeah, Rich Bachman, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean, a lot of his writing, though, I mean, he like writes really great, and then it's like, meh, 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 meh. Okay, now I'm going to finish it, right? And the meh, 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 meh is always like the same in most of the books, because it's like, I don't know where this is going. I'm on some really doped up drugs right now, and eventually I'm going to finish this thing, but... You know, most of the books definitely get like the Troy 20 minutes too long stamp of approval.
Well, I don't know how fast you're reading those books, if it's only 20 minutes, but my God, there's some of them are pretty hefty. Back to my story. So mine was, my mom was harping me, you gotta read more, you gotta read more. She's always been very big on reading. Whenever I needed to know what a word meant, I had to look it up in a dictionary. She wouldn't just tell me. I couldn't just ask her what something meant. I always had to look it up. Whether it be an encyclopedia or a dictionary, it's just how, in her mind, that's how she made me smarter.
I don't think she did such a great job, but
no, she sucked at it. It was terrible. No, but she also loved Stephen King, and I was fascinated because I love my mom, and I want to know why did she love this world so much, these worlds that he created. And I started with The Mist, which is the first thing of his I ever wrote. It's still my favorite thing that he ever wrote. And
you read it, or you watched it.
No, I read it.
You read it. Okay.
The novella. Because I used to read all the time. I don't read as much these days because it's just time. But yeah, all the time when I was younger, especially. And read The Mist, read The Shining shortly after. Which is a big reason why I don't like the movie. Long story.
Yeah, book is definitely way better than the movie.
The book is so fantastic. And then Desperation is probably my favorite all-time book of his. The Mist, I just wouldn't call a book because it's not a book. It's a novella. It's very short. But I love how it ends, and it's beside the point. But those things kind of got me into, okay, this guy, while I get the complaint that you make, right, that sometimes he can dawdle into the weird, the obscene, like, why are we going down this rabbit hole? I mean, it is a perfect example because there's a whole orgy scene that makes still no sense. And it probably never will. And when I was younger and I read it, I'm like, okay, I mean, I think I could go with it. But now that I'm older and I'm like an older man, I'm like, but you know what?
It's a little pervy.
But my thing with him was like, yeah, a little, sure. Yes, definitely a little pervy. But I also think, you know, he had very similar, he had a lot of young frustrations that he came through in his, like, frustrations that most young people have came through in his writing. And I think he captured that very, very well in terms of sexual frustration, bullying, fear, conquering your own inner demons, standing up to foes that are bigger than yourself. The impact of a group, like these kinds of themes that I think so many people try to wrestle with and just never capture. I think Stephen King just got it. And by creating these wild, whimsical, fantastic horror elements, he gave it he gave those particular characters and heroes and heroines a place to shine that I don't think many writers were doing. More writers were so focused on the horror aspect, right? Making it scary or bloody or violent or whatever. And King was, in my opinion, though I know he kind of struggles with endings sometimes, he was focused on the characters. He really was focused on relatable themes, relatable characters going up against impossibly fantastical elements. And that's what made and still makes him relevant today. But that's what first captured my imagination, because it was a very imaginative world without going overboard one way or the other.
I mean, it was a really long-winded way to say that Stephen King is the John Hughes of when he's on drugs.
Sure. That's one way to say it, sure.
Because John Hughes did the same exact thing, right? It's all about the growing up as a kid and what you're doing and how you're dealing with life and transitioning from childhood to adulthood and all that stuff you're facing. It's just that Stephen King did it in a really fucked up way.
But see, I think I relate more to Stephen King, and that's probably why I relate more to Stephen King, because I grew up in a very fucked up kind of environment, had a rough, other than my mom, it was a very rough upbringing. And I clung to that world more than I did this safe, middle class John Hughes world that he had going on. Like, I relate more to, we have constant struggle. How are we going to win? How are we going to beat this? How are we going to get past this? How are we going to get past the alcoholic this or or the maniacal clown or whatever the foe happens to be. That's more logical to me than, I don't know.
I'm not going to get the girl. The girl's going to pick the other guy.
Yeah. Like that stuff doesn't, I don't.
My parents left me behind on vacation.
I don't relate to that. It's interesting though. It's interesting how people see it kind of a different way. So which kind of king do you like the most?
It's hard because I'm not a horror person. I'm not horror. I don't like horror paranormal.
Which is funny because I know that about you, but you do like Stephen King, but you like a portion of him. Like it's not, you don't like him across the board. Like I like him across the board. You're very, I like this, and this.
We grew up with things like Cujo and Carrie and Children of the Corn and Salem's Lot and the Sleepwalkers. And those works are fantastic works of art, right? In their own right. And so I think there's a difference between like those books and something like The Mist, where it's an unknown entity. I would gravitate towards the unknown entity or things that aren't necessarily, I don't want to say done all the time or quote unquote real, but like creatures that you would find in the Dark Tower series aren't things you would see normally in TV and film or in books or in life, right? Okay. Like the Lobstrosities doesn't exist in we'll call it real life for lack of a better term. And I think that's what's really interesting is the fantasticalness that he can create. And then being a fan of things like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia, and to find the Dark Tower and go on that journey where you are living the life of Roland Deschain of Gilead, and you're going and getting the horn and going to the tower and fighting everybody. And just that journey and the people you met along the way, it was like, you can understand why King was into Lost, because like it's that same kind of thing where you're journeying along trying to overcome these obstacles, and it's a grand journey over, well, now it's over 8 books because he had to do Wind Through the Keyhole, which really didn't need to happen, but whatever. Nor did he need to narrate it himself because he's not a great narrator. But
I hope he's not listening.
I hope not.
It's Troy at thehollywoodoutsider.com, Stephen, if you happen to be.
Well, there was an issue with the guy that was narrating the original starting of the Dark Tower. He got like a motorcycle accident, so then he wasn't able to finish the narration for the rest of the books. So That's why Stephen had to pick it up. But yeah, like 11/22/63 is a great example. Like it's something that is like realistic that you can gravitate towards. Here's a guy who's an English teacher who sees this horrible thing about one of his students, and what if he could go fix that? What if he could stop JFK from getting shot? What if time travel is always a very interesting thing? Or powder keg stories like Under the Dome, where you have this town who's just trapped, and what's going to happen? Who's going to come on top? Who's going to band together? You know, how are they going to solve the problem? Anything where it's a solve the problem type of story, I think those are the ones I tend to gravitate towards the most, right? Stand by Me. How do we solve the problem of finding the dead body before our brother does and the rest of his goon friends? So those, I think, are the ones I gravitate towards the most, is solving problems rather than just, ooh, bump in the night, scary.
I think what I gravitate most towards, and I know it has a lot to do with how I grew up, right? I've talked about it before. I grew up poor, blah, 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 blah. Single mom, all that kind of stuff. And I really gravitate towards the stories he tells with kids, because I feel like there aren't many writers. This is my opinion. When I was a kid reading him, I felt like this is a guy who gets kids. Like he understands kids are complicated. Kids are not, I don't know. It's not always a safe space with kids. You know, there's a lot of raunchy shit that happens with kids at various ages. And he wrote to it. Like he always treated them like I feel like parents should treat their children, which treat them like they're people. Stop. Don't talk down to them. Don't talk to them. Look, little Billy, here's what you know. Talk to them. Like if they're being a jackass, you call them out on it. You don't have to say those words, but you call them out on it. And I feel like he always wrote his characters, at least the kids, as if they were real people with real problems, instead of just looking at them like little innocents who have done no wrong. And I really always love that. And I love that aspect of King whenever he does stuff like that. When you're talking about It, you're talking about even Cujo, the little boy in Cujo. You're talking about Salem's Lot has that aspect. And then, of course, Stand By Me and things like that, where they're spawned from smaller stories. But he just knows how to write kids. At least he did at that point, minus the weird thing in It. You don't take that out of it. But that also, I mean, I got what he was going for with it. It just, you know, it's just kind of weird. But overall, he was always an author, and therefore the works that went to screen seem, the ones that worked the best seem to understand how those kids worked, like what made them interesting characters. Like Stand By Me, probably, I know a lot of people point to Breakfast Club as, well, that's the best growing up experience, coming of age, da da da. No, Stand By Me to me is probably so much better than Breakfast Club.
They're different. I mean, and it's,
yeah, they are different.
And it's funny because that's the comparison to John Hughes, right? John Hughes told the story from the preppy kids who go in this really expensive high school neighborhood versus the Stand By Me kids who are like, you know, he's getting his ear burnt on the stove because his dad's a drunk and a vet and all this other stuff, right? And the people are getting neglected. And so they have to band together in this backwater town in order to have adventures. So the juxtaposition of the two kinds of points of view, I think, is really what happens with America now that we're thinking about two different points of view today.
Sure. Yeah, I could see that. I never really could get into Dark Tower. I tried so hard with that one. That's a series I just couldn't get into.
The problem with the Dark Tower is the first book, right? The first book, The Gunslinger, it was like 1977.
So I'm not wrong in thinking it's convoluted, right?
The Dark Tower itself is very like all over the map convoluted.
Okay.
But okay. The problem is that The Gunslinger, where it's a good book and it's very interesting to understand Roland's plight and where he's starting from, the whole freaking thing is told like out of order. So if you would start with book four, which actually gives you the backstory about why the gunslinger is on this journey, and then go back to book one, it probably makes a hell of a lot more sense in the in the scheme of things. Because book four is literally a literary work of art in a sense. It's a story about, you know, the musketeers. It's a story about love. It's a story about witches. It's a story about things that you could actually get behind and understand, because it's probably the most like any normal movie that you would watch today or normal book you would read today. And then you would jump to this, well, why is this guy a wizard? And why can he like shoot everybody without even thinking about it in the blink of an eye? And all this mystical things that happen in The Gunslinger, how he finds Jake, the boy, in that, situation. And it's just like all of that is very interesting, and I think that's why people have a struggle getting into the Dark Tower, because by the time you get to book two, The Drawing of the Three, that one is actually really, really great, because now you're into the, okay, we're on this beach, we got three magical doors, we got to go into them, which goes into people's mind John Malkovich style, and now we bring them into Midworld versus keeping them in the regular universe, and you start to learn how Stephen King connected all of this stuff before you even knew he was connecting it way back in the day. Because you get characters from Salem's Lot, you get characters from It, you get characters from Carrie and Children of the Corn, and they start showing up in the Dark Tower, and then you realize it's all connected in this Stephen King universe, and that's what makes it really cool. Because now you're geeking out on stuff that you're like, oh yeah, I remember that, and oh yeah, I remember that. And then it makes you want to go back and read those books again.
Yeah, he always does cool stuff like that. Like I told you earlier, Desperation is my favorite book of his across the board. And he had The Regulators, which are the same characters, different story. And it was just wild. I mean, it was just, who does that? Who does that and makes it work? He does. He does it all the time. He's always trying to do something creative and innovative in some way. And I think it's because the guy can't stop writing. I mean, he just can't stop writing. Look at him at his age now, and he's still cranking works out. Like when he can.
The end of The Dark Tower in book seven is probably the hardest thing I've ever done in literature in my life, which was put a book down. Because at the end of the book, Stephen King basically like breaks the fourth wall and says, okay, we're here. You can go ahead and turn the page, or you can just stop the story now. It's your choice, but I hope you learned your lesson along the way. And I literally said, okay, fine, I'll put the book down. It was the most agonizing 24 hours of my life. Like, I had to know, like, what was behind the door after he knocked on it. Like, I have to know. And it was like, after 24 hours, I was like, F it, I'm picking this book up and I'm reading it. And then I'm like, page, 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 as fast as I could to get to the end. And I was like, fuck you, Stephen King, you got me.
You shouldn't have read it.
I shouldn't have read it. It's a great ending, though. I mean, it's a great ending, but like, it's just like, oh yeah, I feel stupid now.
Do you remember, I think when you talk about Stephen King, look, the reason why many argue that he's the master of horror is because he crosses all the medias, books, TV, movies. He's done it all. Like, you can find great things on each of those things. There was a time, do you remember, kind of like the golden age of TV movies, where his movies instantly equaled like major ratings.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you remember that. Like, there was a time
the
when
whole 90s, TV movies, those miniseries where it was like four nights.
It was great. I love that period of time. And obviously it, you know, didn't last forever, but I loved it. And that led to some TV shows that we'll talk about in a minute, because you know quite a bit about that. But is there any, because of course I'm a movie guy. I love movies more than anything. So my answer is going to be movies. I have nothing but love for so much of, I mean, I could go down Christine, Children of the Corn. Sometimes They Come Back is a great one. If you've never seen it, Silver Bullet is one of my favorites of all time. I mean, blah, 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 bam, 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 bam. I can just go through a list of movies that I love. But where do you lean? Do you prefer the TV side of it? Or are you okay with everything? A little bit of everything?
Yeah, I mean, I always looked at the books first. I haven't read a lot of the books, but I've read enough of the books. And then I looked And then I looked at the TV series. And it's like, the problem with the TV series, I feel, is that it was a... when they came out in the 90s, it wasn't time for them to do TV. There's things in the books that just looked better with more modern technology, right? If 11/22/63 had been made as a miniseries in the 90s, it wouldn't have done as well as it did when it came to Hulu in the teens of the 2000s. Mm-hmm. Because there's just things that have to, the polish just has to be there in order for you to visually understand what he was going for in the books, I think. And so, like, when you watch things like The Stand from the 90s versus The Stand that was redone recently, I don't know if The Stand recently was the greatest thing in the world, but you could understand that the polish does make it a little bit more tolerable to watch versus, like, doing the original, like, miniseries in the 90s. Like, Gary Sinise is great, but man, it is, like, rough to go back and watch that thing. It's just not, like, polished for what you would be used to seeing today.
Yeah, because TV then was not like TV today, right?
Right. You wrote to the commercial break. You didn't write the story first.
And your budget was $14 versus $14 million.
Right.
So it made a big difference. Yeah.
And you got to cut out a lot of stuff. That's the thing. Like, now, like, with streaming, you could do a really great version of The Stand or The Dark Tower or what have you, and people are trying. But back then, you had, I got 8 hours. What can I put into 8 hours? Or six.
True.
Or two or four, depending on how many nights they got back then.
Oh, and they just had a really great reinvention of Creepshow. I mean, that's been going strong. I think it's still on. I don't know if it still is, but I've watched many episodes from it. It's great because it's an anthology. And that's just, I'm just so glad that that's still a thing that exists, because that first movie was fantastic, and I'm glad it's been reinvented several times over the years.
I think it depends too on the TV shows, like, or the movies specifically, like the movies versus the made for TV movies. Right, because you had things like, I remember The Langoliers was a movie, but it was a made-for-TV movie. It wasn't like released in a theater movie. And those basically had a huge, stark difference in quality because of that. Sure.
Some were underappreciated. Like, what was the Storm one?
Storm of the Century?
Storm of the Century. I thought that was really, really well done. Like, it was a really captivating event. Because they sold it as kind of an event.
Right.
And there's other stuff you don't even realize is based on Stephen King. At Pupil is based on a Stephen King novella. And that's, I think, a fantastic movie. Running Man is based on a Stephen King story. Like, there's so many little things. 1408, that's from a short story. Cat's Eye, blah, blah, blah. Lawnmower Man. And, like, there's a bunch of little... Gerald's Game, which, if you've never seen that, that's such a great movie. Like, that movie really is great. There are so many things I don't even think people realize are based on something from Stephen King, because... wasn't the deal that he had at one point, and I'm trying to remember specifics, was he would let filmmakers make his property, take his property and run with it for like a buck, as long as they had like a really creative idea and a real passion for it. Something like that. Like,
yep.
You know what I'm talking about?
Totally.
That was the story. I don't know how much of that's accurate, but I believe it's fairly accurate. He would take a very minimal
cut,
residual,
yeah,
just to give him a chance, because he wrote so much. He's like, go ahead. I got plenty of money. Make it your own. And I think that's great. Like, there's so much quality out there. Yes, there's some junk, but there's also a lot of quality. Mostly quality.
Yeah.
Hey! Yeah. I hope he's listening. I hope so. I really do. I mean, he's got classics, man. Like, name another author who has as many classics as he does, right? So,
like I said, the movies and the books, yes. Like the TV series, that's where it gets a little.
Okay, fine. Fine, but if you go through like the movies, you know, your Green Mile, Pet Sematary,
Salem's
Running
Lot.
Man, I would say Shawshank Redemption, Children of the Corn, Christine, Stand by Me, Cujo, blah 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 blah. Like you can just go Misery. Jesus, how can we not mention Misery? There's just so many, and they just keep going and going and going. Like there's a whole list of them. I don't know how you make an argument that there's anyone producing better ideas than Stephen King over the last four decades.
Especially
for horror.
Don't forget Dreamcatcher.
I think we should forget Dreamcatcher if we can. I don't even like that book, honestly. But
What are you gonna do? I don't even know how Stephen King like wrote those giant eyebrows. That's what I want to know. The description of text of that is just amazing.
And here I'll even go on the record. And by the way, Carrie is fantastic. Carrie's
a great movie for its
fire
for time.
Yeah, Carrie was. It was. And I will go on the record and say, I think Maximum Overdrive is entertaining.
It's entertaining as hell.
It's kind of, I know, 80s cheese, and it's pretty wild because now it could probably happen. You know, if Elon gets his hands on some shit. So, yeah, I think that movie, it's about time people say, you know what, Maximum Overdrive, not so bad. Fantastic soundtrack, by the way.
Fantastic soundtrack. But
like the
Mist, I mean, The Mist is just a short story, and what it produced from a movie perspective, the movie's so good. It's so good for what, and then Stand By Me. Like it's a 90 page PDF at most, you know, the body.
Yeah. Simple story.
Simple story. And it's like one of the best movies of all time. Launched Will Wheaton's career. It's crazy.
And people took that, fleshed it out, made it their own. I mean, The Mist, if you've never read the novella, The Mist, there is no real ending. Like it's basically they continue. I think it ends in a hotel, they end up at a different hotel or something like that. And the mist keeps following them. Like it just keeps going. Well, Darabont in the movie gave it an ending. Now you might hate that ending, but he gave it an ending, and that's a ballsy ending that Stephen King loved. That's taking a chance because he could have said, no, you're not doing that to my book. My book was meant to be something that it never really has an ending. There is no conclusion and there is nothing dire like happened in the movie. But instead, you know, he lets creators create, take his idea and make it their own. And I think that's something that doesn't get appreciated much because studios don't do that. they're all over everything. But Stephen King, he loves creation. He loves creativity. And there's something to be said for that. Now I got to watch Maximum Overdrive again.
Tommyknockers. Emilio. How do we forget about Tommyknockers?
It's okay to forget that one, I think. Are you a big fan of that one?
It's okay. It's watchable. It's good.
It's okay. It's watchable. Put that in the box, right?
Yeah.
Jesus. It's okay. It's watchable.
Look,
there's some great ones out there that didn't get their fair shake either. I think Thinner's a great story, just a terrible movie. You know, that could have been so much better. And it's still relevant. I feel like. So what other ones like that are rarely talked about that you're fond of?
I mean, I know it gets shit on all the time because of the CGI and everything, but the concept of the Langoliers, I really dig the concept of the Langoliers. It's a story about a plane that goes through a rift and goes back in time. And
it's like Lost. That's why you like it.
No, not because it's Lost. It's because when you think about time is ever existing, right? The past is there. The future is there. We're moving through time. And as we move along, like what happens after we go past a certain point? And so when this plane goes back into the past, like they're still alive. They're just moving now on a different timeline, but everything else has moved ahead. So like they eat a Twinkie and the Twinkie is stale, or they go to a spot and there's like, the ball game is like on the radio, but it's like a different time period of the ball game, you know, and then just to have these creatures that are literally now chewing up the past because you can't just leave shit hanging out forever because it'll take up too much space. I mean, that concept is just super interesting. And then at the end, when they actually go back through the rift and go into the future, they have to stand there and wait for the rest of the world to catch up to them because they're at that future point, but the people haven't caught up to that part of the timeline yet. So it's not that they're moving in time, they're stuck in time, either stuck in the past or stuck in the future. So the concept of that's just really good. It's just the CGI and Bronson Pinchot's crazy paper tearing weird stuff that he does in that movie is just creepy. But overall, the concept of that is really, really great.
I'd throw a shout toward Dolores Claiborne,
yeah,
too, if you never saw that. I mean, once again, Kathy Bates, really can't go wrong with her.
I think both of us are pretty big fans of Hearts in Atlantis.
Yeah, I like Hearts in Atlantis.
Yeah.
I do. It's much more emotional venture.
Yeah, it's more connective to a more wider general audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think absolutely. Those are some of the King's actually, I think those are some of King's best work, to be honest. Yes, he's the master of horror. And you got Dogs and Cats and Pet Cemetery and Cujo and Children of the Corn and Care and all that stuff. But like Hearts at Atlantis, 112263, things of that nature, Kingdom Hospital, like things that have like connective stories. It's more people can be exposed to Stephen King's concepts. And then if they're like horror, go this way. If you like time travel, go this way. If you like, you know, just out of the box, weird stuff, then you can go under the dome, I guess. I don't know.
Speaking of, all right, we can't just not talk about this. So you've done how many Stephen King podcasts now, like direct podcasts?
Two.
So it was Under the Dome, and what was the other one?
112263: A Look Back was the tagline we put on it.
And you, what that means is they were podcasts. Troy covered every episode of both of those things, right? So my question to you, and I know you really hoped Under the Dome would have ended in season one because you thought that was perfect. Like, you liked the first season, right?
And yeah, the first season followed the book pretty closely. I found it interesting what they were trying to do with it, and then it went off the rails.
So what did you learn anything about Stephen King fans doing that? If that sounds weird, like, are they the really hyper devoted? Are they normal? Do they really want to have conversations about the themes? You know, what is a Stephen King fan like doing those books?
Honestly, it was hard listening to the fans when we did Under the Dome Radio, because the reason why we called it Under the Dome Radio is there's an actual radio tower in the town of Chester's Mill that's actually a very focal point of the story in the books. So wasn't so much a big part of the story in the TV show, but that's why we called the podcast Under the Dome Radio, play on the podcast concept too, I guess. And what we actually found was the other people that were doing the Under the Dome podcasts out there were the more avid Stephen King people than the people that were just watching the TV series. The TV series fans were just like, how do I make fun of this as much as possible? And to the point where by season three on that podcast, we were doing everything we could to say how bad it was without saying how bad it was. And then people would actually call in with their own scenarios of what would happen in the next week and do like little mini plays. And there's a guy that called in like a 6-minute feedback every time. And it was like, what is his story this week of where he's at? And inside of Chester's Mill, he made up his own little drama inside the dome. And it was like, it was more entertaining than the show, to be honest. Because that's a case where the creator idea like went way off the rails from what Stephen King originally had planned. Under the Dome originally, the original concept of Under the Dome was supposed to be a bunch of people trapped in a New York apartment, like a New York apartment building, can't get out. And they had to basically, the community had to evolve while they stuck inside of this apartment building. That was the original plan. And then
that sounds really interesting, actually.
It does. And then it was just like, well, there's not enough space to move to make an environment. So they, you know, broadened it to an entire town and then had a giant contact lens fall on top.
Well, there was that.
It's not a contact lens. I didn't give away the ending.
Did you find the fans the same when you did 112263, or wasn't at all the same kind?
No, the 112263 fans were like history buffs. Like, they were all into like, well, that wouldn't happen in the JFK time, and that wasn't quite the same way. But like, those people were the ones that were picking it apart a little bit from the history perspective. And then the other side of the coin were the fans that were all about the time travel. So they were like, oh, when he went back in this episode, this didn't happen this time. And when they went back in this episode, this didn't happen this time. And then you had a third sect of fans, which were truly the Stephen King, like, did you pick up on this Easter egg? Did you pick up on this Easter egg? And so a lot of the times the credits of that show actually changed week to week based on what was happening in the episode. So part of the podcast stuff that we did was actually had to analyze the credits, take screenshots of everything, put it on the blog so people then could say, oh, I didn't know that was happening. I didn't know the string was red or the thing would change to yellow or there's a pumpkin on the porch and the title of the record changed. So, I mean, it was very much more of a Lost Cerebral type community experience or Game of Thrones type community experience for that particular podcast because there's just so much to it because time changes and because of that, things change and it was cool to play with.
That's cool. So when you look back on your life, your experiences with Stephen King, like what are the most memorable moments from any film or TV prop? Because obviously we're filming TV. It's what we're focused
on. Oh, I mean, yeah. So, the first time I ever got a leech on me, terrified, scared to death I was going to die because of Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Like I said, I never bought a red balloon. Still don't look at red balloons. Every time I saw, it was really funny. Our school colors in our town that we're in are red, black, and gray. And they had a homecoming event, right? And so one of the kids like just left a balloon hanging in the car. And it was like that part where it was like not heliumed enough that it would float away, but not heliumed less that it would sink to the ground. So it literally was just floating there. And I came around the corner into my neighborhood and it's literally floating above a storm sewer. And I was like, nope. I like you turned the shit out of that thing. And I went a completely different way into my neighborhood. Cause I That's was funny. Like, yeah, this isn't like either somebody did this on purpose and I'm going to kill him, or it's just like, there's just visceral things like that you're like, no way.
Yeah. Obviously Silver Bullet, is my first one that comes to mind. That movie has really, really hit me for a very, very long time. And just the relationship between the uncle and the boy who needs his help and someone actually believes in him. And then his sister believes in him. Like that whole family dynamic of believing in him when they shouldn't, because it's such a ridiculous tale, right? Like the whole idea is ridiculous. So that coming together really, really still sticks with me. The ending to The Mist is a huge one, which we talked about, just because that's so not the book. And I give him credit for going against the book, or the novella, as it were. And I will say, even though I don't like the movie The Shining, the maze and having him freeze out there is a fantastic image. The Here's Johnny is a fantastic image that kind of sticks with you and has through pop culture. Much like I'm just throwing off a bunch that made sense to me or still resonate with me. Cujo, that dog for a long time terrified me of all dogs, just like Jaws. I mean, it was like the shark from Jaws to me. It just absolutely, you know, really, really terrified me. Just still does. Like, I don't want a St. Bernard in my house. I just don't.
Well, even as recent as like 2020, you know, The Stand was like a profound thing of like, oh, a global virus that could like wipe out people.
And, oh, for sure.
And then there was the whole battle between like the good people in Las Vegas and Randall Flagg taking over. And it's like, you know, I want to get political, but it's like, well, now you got Trump. It's like a Randall Flagg and using the arsenal. It was just like, is this happening? Like, I thought this was a story. This isn't real. And then when it got real in 2020, it was like, oh, shit, you know? Like Stephen King actually can see the future after he got hit by that van.
Poor guy. Also other big moment, Gage getting hit by that truck.
Yeah.
And coming back. Yeah. The kid, I mean, that was cute when he came back and he's just, some play with me or whatever. But it really, really kind of just took the wind out of my sails. Like it was just so impactful and so horrific at the same time. And also it was his wife's sister when they show her in flashbacks. I mean, that was kind of horrific in the movie. If you remember back when she had meningitis and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah. That was pretty horrific. I thought there's been a lot of it. And I will say Misery made me afraid of just people in general. Like I just don't want to be taken care of by any one person. Cause I'm afraid what happens if nobody else comes to check on me.
Well, we've been doing podcasting for 13 years now. It's like, I'm waiting for that rabid podcast fan to come like tie me down to a bed and start hacking off my feet and stuff. It's like,
Good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know. That's only you. I do not have that interest. Just keep on walking.
I don't have the interest. I'm surprised it hasn't happened. I fear because of movies like Misery, right? Like those things like they're close enough that they could happen, that's what makes the horror part of it actually feel real, because it's not like horror manufactured. It's horror that could actually happen.
And the other thing I will say, because Salem's Lot obviously came out, I will tell you, if you haven't seen it, I enjoyed it. I mean, yes, you can tell it's been compacted a little bit. It was originally a 3-hour cut, and it's down to about 2 hours. I find it really entertaining. I had a great time with it. But I will say, the original movie, for whatever miniseries, the original that came out in 79 with David Soul, when it had the kid tapping on the window in the original,
yes,
that creeped the shit out of me. Terrified me. Absolutely horrified.
Anytime the tree hits the window outside my bedroom, you know, because it's like close enough and the wind blows strong enough, that is the immediate image I have.
Oh. Just going to go to bed with a little cross made of my little town every night until Halloween is over, because now I'm going to be a little creeped out.
Well, even like Running Man, like you think about Running Man and what its purpose was and reality TV and how people are betting on it and everything, and now how much reality TV do we have now?
So far ahead of time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird movie, but at the same time, it's interesting just because Richard Dawson was a weird guy to begin with.
You can see it happening now, though, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Like, if you win, you can basically take down the corporation. You can take down the broadcast, take down the government. I mean, basically, that's what Hunger Games was all about.
Absolutely. All right. So, in closing, I'm going to ask a question, but don't answer yet.
Okay.
I know you got your answer, like you're ready to go, but don't answer yet. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the question, and then I'm going to read some listener thoughts, hear them out. We can discuss them, and then you and I can answer.
Oh, this sounds very like End of Dark Tower.
That's exactly what I was going for. Even though I didn't read it. So the question is this, very simply: is Stephen King the master of horror? Don't answer that. That's the question. Is Stephen King the master of horror? And we asked this on our Facebook group and on X at Buy Popcorn. And we're also on Threads at The Hollywood Outsider. And Discord, blah, 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 blah. So here's some of the responses. Jeff Gentry, okay? He says, I think he does horror, but if you look at the bulk of his writing, it is not the main genre, which is, I'm surprised to hear someone say that, but fair enough. So I wouldn't call him the master of...
Jeff Gentry also did the Castle Rock Zone podcast. So,
oh, Castle Rock. There's another good call out.
Well, the first season, second season. Yeah.
So I wouldn't call him the master of horror, but I would say he does it well. It and The Shining are great examples of how he takes his time to tell why a place is bad and how that place being bad leads to horror. Do you feel that this is an accurate statement to say it's not his main genre?
I would say so.
Really?
Well, I can't answer that without answering the question, so we got to go to the next person.
Okay, fair enough. I would say everything he does has an element of horror to it. That's what I would say.
Yes.
Doesn't mean that they're gory and, you know, like I was talking about earlier. It's about story and characters primarily, and there's a horror element.
Horror is whatever scares you. For some people, that's Monday morning. You could write a whole book on Monday morning. And it would be Stephen King.
The Office scares the shit out of me. Jennifer Miller, horror, like all genres, is nuanced. Stephen King is the master of his type of horror, but I can't classify one person the master of the umbrella genre of horror. I don't mean that as a cop-out, but Hitchcock horror or Carpenter horror are very different from King horror, but he is prolific and a master of his horror. I can see that.
That's a fair statement.
A little bit of a cop-out, though.
No, but I mean, everybody's position on horror is different, right? So it's like whatever scared Stephen King is what he's going to write about. You write from experience.
Mm-hmm. Chris Spid, is he a master, yes, of great writing and characters? His books are more than horror. There's somebody else saying it's more than horror. They are King. The Shining is a great example. It's truly about alcoholism. Thank you for noticing, because Kubrick didn't. It's coming of age, finding friends and love, abuse, and how it's overcome. He is brilliant, and the fact that he can't remember writing some of his books due to his own personal demons says it all. That's good thoughts. And I want to mention Stephen Barras. So many iconic characters and stories that are still being reimagined today, with Salem's Lot being the most recent and written 50-odd years ago. If there was a genre named Stephen King, everyone would know what it was. And that, to me, means he's the master of horror. That's a great point. That is a great point. You could literally say it's Stephen King-esque, and people would understand. Very much like if you said something was Hitchcockian, it would resonate with you. More, Jen Ryan, my daughter and I both agree he absolutely is. I mean, have you read his books? We think so, because his books, short stories, movies, cover such a wide variety of horrific situations. Gore, paranormal, sci-fi, fantasy, psychological. He could scare people with a hotel, a dog, a car, hell, even an innocent man going to prison. His passages of descriptive scenes may be long, but they paint a picture so clear the reader is able to picture the world easily, which in our opinion, her and her daughter, adds to the scenes, making them even more terrifying. I think Jen's on my line of sight there. Good thoughts, though. That's good.
Definitely.
Now, here's the last one I want to read. Ty Nelson. Well, here, Jen Schleider up. He says he was, but he doesn't really write much horror anymore, apart from the occasional short story. He does write better than he ever did, though. Now than he ever did, though, which is funny. But I would say...
drugs anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But I would also say, I mean, his stories are still being remade. They're still being, they still permeate the culture, right?
There's a noticeable dip somewhere in the middle, though.
Maybe. Stuart Bannerman, he is a master. Is he the master? I'd say Hitchcock is the master of cinema. King is the master of words.
Could you imagine if there was like a team up?
Well, you'd make my day. You really would. Because my mom would be on cloud nine. All right. So Ty Nelson, he said this, and I thought this is a good way to close. I'm currently reading Fairy Tale. I'm only on page 137 of 600. And that's a Stephen King book, if you didn't know. So far, there have just been hints of a supernatural threat. There's been one murder off screen, but that's not what has been frightening. It's been the existential fears that have gripped me. Mortality, addiction, grief, and fear of an unknown future. Does that qualify as horror? I think so. It also illustrates why King is a master. He can make the realistic and mundane as scary as any monster you can imagine. This, coupled with relatable characters, really showcase what makes him great. On a side note, his settings are amazing. This book is set somewhere around the northern suburbs of Chicago. I know Century's Rest is a fictional town, but I spent a good 5 minutes trying to figure out exactly where it would be. I think that says a lot right there. This is some great, detailed layer thoughts from people that you obviously know are big fans of Stephen King. So that brings me back to you. Is he the master of horror?
I will say yes, in the sense of defining horror as not necessarily all the things that go bump in the night, but all the things that go bump in your head. Because I'm going to take 11-22-63 to state this point, because in 11-22-63, there's the horror of what happened to George Ambrose's student, right, in his class. There's that kind of horror, family violent crime horror. There's also the horror of the ability to go back in time, and every time you go back in time in this particular story, you can change things and come back to the future, but never quite get it right. So you're constantly going back in time and trying again and trying again and trying again. And so there's the existential crisis of, will I ever do the right move in order to make happen what I need happen? And what kind of like obsession does that cause? So there's that kind of horror. And then you have the horror of the past itself throwing shit at you left and right, because the first time you went back, a tree fell right before you got, you know, coming down the road and blocked the road. The next time, the tree falls on your freaking car. So every time you go back and change something, the past is fighting back harder and harder, and you have no idea when it's going to catch up to you. So there's that kind of horror. But the reason why 11-22-63 is the best story out of them all, in my opinion, from a horror perspective, is it's because the horror of never, ever being with the woman you love. And it's gut-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching. And like, I couldn't even think of like a worse horror in that moment than to have someone that you love that deeply and can never be with them.
Aw, you're a softie. That's a great answer, by the way. And especially, I really love the bumps. Not instead of bumps in the night, things that go bump in your head. I think that's great. I said it earlier, and I mean it. Like he brings to life everyday horrors, right? Things that you normally wouldn't find terrifying. Dogs, most people do not find dogs terrifying, but you give one rabies, suddenly they're terrifying. Kids, they're not terrifying, but you get them to band together and they hang out in a cornfield, suddenly creepy as hell. Clowns. A lot of people used to love clowns before Pennywise came around, you know? The Dead Zone. I'm pretty sure it's a documentary at this point.
So, it's a true statement. Isn't it? It is. Well played.
You know, Shawshank, that story, just the idea of being wrongfully imprisoned, and you know, that's a horror in itself.
Well, and the horror on that one too is not necessarily being wrongfully imprisoned, but at the same time, the horror that you've spent so much time in the prison, can I actually reacclimate to real life?
Sure. There. Perfect. Stand by Me. The horror in that one, I mean, yeah, there's a horror element in it because you have the boys are afraid of a bully. And also when you're kids, you get all excited, I'm going to go see this dead body, but then you see it and it's horrific. Like it's not what you wanted because now you're faced with your own mortality because of, you know, your own life and da, 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 da. Like there are all these elements that he finds. Pet Cemetery, the loss of a child. Like there are so many elements that, yes, he might inject a horror trope. Misery. You meet a super fan and the super fan is the most terrifying thing in the world. Christine, you're afraid of you gotta be afraid of a car, for Christ's sake. Like he made a car scary. Like there's all these things that he manages to do. And I agree. He does not write in terms of, it's not all about vampires and monsters. He can make so many aspects of just everyday life horrific. And I think that does make him a master of horror. And I think he's managed to he's managed to dominate all forms of media. That's what I'm trying to say. Like he's managed to dominate TV, books, audiobooks. I mean, he's got those too. And film, obviously. He permeates the culture.
For 50 years.
Yeah, some of the most famous directors have covered his work. Kubrick, Reiner, Frank Darabont, Mike Flanagan has become an established horror. Midnight Mass was basically Salem's Lot, in case you missed it. Same freaking story. George Romero, I mean, like, the list goes on and on. Like, the legends admire him. They know his work resonates with the people because it starts with the characters and it ends with the horror. It doesn't start with the horror and forget about character. Like, characters always matter, and especially if you really read his work.
Did you hear that, everybody? Aaron said the characters matter, not the story, not the things on the island.
No, I never said the story doesn't matter, Losty. All right? I said the characters and the story matter. He makes both. See, that's what happens when you can actually write. You make an ending that people, all right. Touche. There's a few wild instances there where we could probably pull that
one. A few.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely think he's a master of horror. And in fact, for those that would say he's not, tell me who's better than Stephen King. Over the course of 4 decades, give me someone with even close to that kind of record.
Or volume of work.
Yeah. And you can't just say, well, he made Graveyard Shift. Okay, so you're going to take one movie that was based on his work and that discounts all the other ones that we've talked about already? Nonsense. Just nonsense.
Think about the number of volumes of work that he's done compared to other authors. And if he's got a Graveyard Shift sitting in there out of all those other things, like that one author that made like maybe wrote one good thing also had a Graveyard Shift.
Sure. Absolutely.
Might be the only thing they have is Graveyard Shift.
Hey, there's a lot of great Clive Barker. Clive Barker is a good writer. He's got a lot of really weird horror out there. And I know some people love him, but I don't think his work has come anywhere close to the popularity of Stephen King. And I'm not knocking him. I'm just saying, like, find someone that comes close. Joe Hill. He's getting there. He's got quite a list of work. That's his son, who is starting to look more and more like him as he gets older. Like, he's morphing into his dad completely. I don't know if you follow Joe Hill or not, but wild.
It's wild.
Well, I just want to say, in case Mr. King does listen to this, thank you for everything, because you really have made my life different. And if you ever want an interview, Aaron@thehollywoodoutsider.com. I would love to talk to you, even for 15 minutes. It would be great. What a dream. But with that, now we want to head back into the vault and play our Stephen King movie battle royale, where we limited it, broke it down to 8 freaking fantastic movies and had to decide which one is actually the best Stephen King movie of all time. And we did it. We've did it. And if you've never heard it, it's a fun listen. If you have heard it, still a fun listen. And fun fact, Troy was only a guest on that particular episode.
That's true.
Before he became permanent.
That's true. So,
because he finally had free time after he gave up all those other TV podcasts. Oh, God.
So many TV podcasts.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks, Troy, for joining me for this.
Absolutely.
Appreciate
it. As always.
Anybody that's in the path of weather, please be safe. And here is our Stephen King movie battle royale.
The next time you step into the thinny, buy popcorn.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is time for the Hollywood Outsider Movie Battle Royale. That is where we take 8 films, 2 favorites from each of our hosts, and we determine which one is the ultimate greatest film in the entire Ho universe. It is definitely a lot of fun, and it is time to get to it. Let's decide what is the greatest film of a genre. It's time for the Movie Battle Royale. That's right. It's the Stephen King Adaptation Edition. Before we get to the rules, I guess. Welcome, Troy Heinrichs.
I do have the shine. Thanks for having me here.
A lot of people don't know what that means, man.
That was cheesy.
They will by the time this is over.
All right. Well, this is our Stephen King Movie Battle Royale. As I said, if you've never heard our battles before, we select our top 8 candidates and vote away to decide what is the greatest film of its kind in hostory. That's too cheesy.
That was way too far.
Ho-history. We did it different this time. This time we let listeners and those in our Facebook group vote on the 8 finalists. So while we're deciding the ultimate winner, you guys decided who the final 8 were going to be. Mostly so you can't bitch at us that one of them didn't make it to the final 8. Boom.
Way to sound hostile to our fans or our listeners. Or I mean, I guess calling them fans is too presumptuous.
I just want to say thank you to the fans for not voting for Dreamcatcher.
Did you really think it was going to be an issue?
John sounded offended.
Jumped on Dream
did the remake. I'm not talking about it again.
Yeah, it's a bad movie. Awful. Okay, one other stipulation. This is important before you actually vote. The quality of the adaptation can be a factor in your vote, but ultimately we are voting on what are the best movies, not necessarily what is the absolute closest to King's original work, because I'm sure that's exactly the kind of comments we're going to get no matter which way we vote. I don't care what you vote for. Somebody's going to say this other movie was much closer to the book. And honestly, if we did that, we'd have to bounce a few of these out already. The Shining, you know, there's some movies that just aren't that faithful, but are still great movies based on Stephen King's work. So that's what we're basing on. Best movie. Clear?
Crystal.
Clear.
I guess.
Well, at least you're convinced. All right, with that, let's get into this. We do Ho North and Ho South. Each person presents their 2 movies and why they should be voted for, each one of them. Then they collect the vote, and then we'll move on to the semifinals. Amanda, you go first. Ho North, go ahead.
My first one is Pet Sematary from
1989. What's the bottom of the truth?
Well, sometimes that is better. The person you put up there ain't the person that comes back. It may look like that person, but it ain't that person. Because whatever lives in the ground beyond that cemetery ain't human at all.
After tragedy strikes, a grieving father discovers an ancient burial ground behind his home with the power to raise the dead. Creepy cats, creepy children, children who get hit by trains and their shoes go flying. This is a pretty good movie. People come back from the dead. Animals come back from the dead. It's awesome. Some of the interesting facts that I found about this is Stephen King required the movie to be filmed in Maine and his screenplay to be followed rigorously. As has been mentioned earlier in the show, he's the one who wrote the script. So it's obviously something that from the novelist himself had a lot of deciding factor and power into what went into this movie. But it's still a great movie even without that. The original cut of the film delivered to Paramount's executives was judged to be too long, so excess footage had to be removed. They also decided that the closing scene was too tame, and at their request, it was reshot to be more graphic. I thought this was a great point to bring up, because who doesn't want more graphic content in their Stephen King film, right?
Whatever makes it a better movie.
It made it better.
Okay.
Also, the budget was, not that this really helps it too much, $11.5 million, and it grossed $57 million. And Bruce Campbell was set to be the first choice for the role of Lewis Creed.
I knew that.
Sad tears that he wasn't. But the casting still worked really great.
I think Dale Midkiff is great.
This is a good movie. And obviously, lots of people voted for it. So It's a great pick.
What's your second one?
My second is Stand By Me from 1986.
Could he have gotten all the way from Chamberlain to Harlem? That's really far.
Sure. He must have started walking on the train tracks and just followed them the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And then after dark, train must have come along and I'll smacko.
Yeah. Hey, you guys. I bet you anything that if we find him, we'll get our pictures in the paper.
Yeah, yeah, we can even be on TV.
Sure.
We'll be heroes.
After the death of a friend, a writer recounts a boyhood journey to find the body of a missing boy. It has Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Jerry O'Connell, Corey Feldman, and Kiefer Sutherland, who's amazing. After director Rob Reiner screened the movie for Stephen King.
Are you saying Will Wheaton is not amazing?
No, I am. They're all amazing.
Okay.
They're all amazing.
Because he's Crusher. You know what I'm saying?
They're all amazing.
Just letting you know. Okay.
Continue. Even the ones who have passed, RIP. After director Rob Reiner screened the movie for Stephen King.
Wait, hang on. That actually is RIP because it's River Phoenix. So I'm just having a whole brain thing going on right now.
What is going on right
Sorry,
now?
Sorry, I interrupted you twice. Go ahead.
You have like a severe ADD tonight.
You said RIP and I'm like, wait, does she mean his initials? Holy shit.
Is his middle name an I?
It is now.
Oh my gosh. Well, anyway, when the movie was screened for Stephen King, he noticed that director had noticed that King was visibly shaking and wasn't speaking. He left the room and upon his return told Reiner that the movie was the best adaptation of his work he had ever seen, which is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
To have your, I mean, he didn't write the script on this one, but he had somebody who, the director, that he really believed in and, I mean, physically made him shake from watching this movie. There's also some really interesting parts that I found out about this. Other than, I mean, okay, so the movie is amazing and it's also a classic and it's, I even watched part of this in school. I don't think I should have watched part of this in school.
Really? Like in class?
Like in middle school.
What are they teaching? This is how you find a body, kids.
I think it was just about read. It was like an English class. Oh, it was like, okay. But we didn't read the book. So I don't. Well,
it's a very short story. So.
Yeah, I have it. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it when I first bought it, that's what it was from. The body was from this. Anyway, in the campfire scene in which Chris breaks down, Rob Reiner was sure River Phoenix could do better. He asked him to think of a time in his own life when an adult had let him down and use it in the scene, which Phoenix did. Upset and crying, he had to be comforted by the director afterwards. The result of Phoenix's exercise is a scene that ended in the final cut, which is pretty spectacular too, and also really traumatic to make a child that frantic. But also, the performances were so captivating because they were real, raw emotions that were brought to life. River Phoenix did lose his virginity thanks to this movie.
With Corey Feldman?
No. Oh. But Corey Feldman did have his first experience drinking alcohol, kissing a girl off screen, and smoking pot for the first time. So this movie really set some set their lives on a new stage. They also got some pot cookies. But
what does any of that have to do with the movie?
It doesn't, but they're fun facts. Okay, so here's the last thing. This is how much people believed in this movie before it even began filming. Coca-Cola bought Embassy Pictures, the film's original production company, and announced it wasn't going to fund the film just 2 days before production was to begin. Norman Lear, who had worked with Rob for years on All in the Family, mm-hmm. was one of the three owners of Embassy prior to its sale. He believed in the project so much that he agreed to personally foot the film's $8 million budget. I'm not throwing anybody $8 million, but if I do, like this man, it's probably for a good reason. This film has spectacular child actors, a great story, and it's one that lives on. So those are my two picks.
Okay.
Troy, our guest, what is your choice between Pet Sematary and Stand By Me?
Well, Pet Sematary itself is creepy as all get out because I hate animals to begin with, and I hate animals that come back to life even more. But just the entire concept happens. Of the fact that he moved away from Chicago to come to this place, this creepy ass in the woods where trucks hit everything that come down the highway. I mean, you get property taxes have to be even higher there because of all the accidents, plus the creepy woods in the back. Move back to Chicago, dude. But Stand By Me is by far the better movie. it's the best Stephen King adaptation. It's almost word for word to the body. I have to add in a little bit just for screen presence. Plus, it has an amazing remake that was done. So I will vote for Stand By Me in a heartbeat.
Good pick. Johnny, what's yours?
I'm going to have to go with Stand By Me for all the reasons that Troy just said, with the exception of the adaptation, because I don't know any of that because I don't read. But on the flip side of that, Pet Sematary was a movie that I just never resonated with me. It never really did anything for me. And least of all, it didn't scare me because, like, you know, not scary.
Oh, well then, not good enough for you. Mm-hmm. Aaron, is Pet Sematary good enough for you?
It's very close, actually. Like, legitimately, I've had to debate this all day. Because I love both movies. I don't care what anybody says. That Pet Sematary won. Dale Midkiff is great in that movie. He gets zero appreciation, and I make fun of him for the no scene.
It's so great.
But it's really, he does everything Jason Clarke doesn't do. He convinces me why a guy would want to do the things he does in that movie and dig up and bury his wife and hope she comes back and, you know, his kid and everything. All that stuff he does, I get why he does it in that movie. So, but Stand By Me is really, it's not perfection to me. It's not a perfect movie, but it's a great film. It is a great film. And I have to pick that one. It doesn't matter what I'm at because it's already Stand By Me.
Well, anyway, yeah, but we still like to know.
It would still be Stand By Me.
Wow.
It's not my favorite Stephen King adaptation, as you're about to find out, but it's definitely, it's up there.
Okay. Well, Stand By Me moves on.
All right. That's my turn. My first movie is The Mist.
Going out now, Mrs. Carmody. Please stand aside.
You can't go out. I won't allow it.
Won't allow it?
It's against God's will. Don't you know that by now? Haven't I proven myself again and again and again? Haven't I shown that I am his vessel? What's the matter with you? Don't you believe in God?
No one's interfered with you. All we're asking for is the same privilege.
The plot revolves around members of the small town of Bridgeton, Maine, who, after a severe thunderstorm, causes the power to go out the night before, they meet in the supermarket to pick up supplies. While they struggle to survive, an unnatural mist envelops the town and conceals vicious Lovecraftian monsters as extreme tensions rise among the survivors, all probably because of those damn scientists on Arrowhead Mountain. And be wary of Mrs. Carmody, because she's nuts. The Mist is my all-time favorite Stephen King story, by a mile. I mean, it's a short novella, but it's my favorite one, by a mile. Favorite book is Desperation. That's a whole other story. So it's no surprise that I took this one, but let me tell you what's so great about the movie. Written and directed by Frank Darabont, who helmed three films in our top eight. Three in this top eight are directed by Frank Darabont. So I really feel it's going to be a Darabont battle royale at some point. The Mist stars Thomas Jane as a father determined to protect his son, Andre Brower as his lawyer neighbor Brent, Lori Holden as Amanda Dumfries, and Marcia Gay Harden as a religious nut, Mrs. Carmody. The novella doesn't have an ending, okay? It actually concludes with several of them continuing into the mist. But Darabont wanted to try something different, so he gave this film one of the most controversial endings in film history, I would argue. I won't spoil what it is, but it's bold, it's grim, and it's horrific. And of course, Stephen King approved, which I think is saying a lot. Now, there are some fun facts as well. The monsters are terrifying more so in the black and white version that Darabont preferred. You can find it on a home video. But the movie was scarier because it showed how quickly people will turn on each other when terrified. How they'll come to believe in things they previously didn't, like God, and how quickly humanity can spiral out of control. But Frank Darabont agreed to make the film with Dimension only under the condition that no matter what, they would not change the scripted ending. They agreed, but Darabont had to forfeit his director's salary.
What?
That's how committed he was to getting this done. Because they had to cut the budget in half because the ending is very dire. It's not a Hollywood ending in any way, shape, or form. During an action scene in the film, a man runs into a wire-rotating bookshelf in the grocery store, and if you look carefully, you can clearly see that all of the books on the shelf are written by Stephen King. Aha. Mm. Uh-huh. And also, this is kind of an interesting fact. Jeffrey DeMunn, Melissa McBride, Lori Holden, Juan Gabriel Pereira, Sherry Dvorak, Sam Witwer, and Tiffany Morgan are all in The Walking Dead, adapted to TV by Frank Darabont. And he also wanted Thomas Jane, who plays the star here, for Rick Grimes. but it just didn't work out. There's a connection.
So, did not know that one.
Yeah. The Mist made $57 million worldwide. It has a 72% approval rating based on 142 reviews. Bloody Disgusting ranked the film number 4 on their list of the top 20 horror films of that decade. There was a 10-episode series adaptation on Spike TV, but it only lasted one season because you don't need a TV show when you got this damn movie. That's my first pick, The Mist. Number 2 is Misery.
Well, it's brilliantly written, but then everything you write is brilliant.
Pretty rough stuff.
The swearing, Paul. There, I said it.
The profanity bothers you.
It has no nobility.
These are slum kids. I was a slum kid. Everybody talks like that.
They do not? What do you think I say when I go to the feed store in town? Oh, now, Wally, give me a bag of that effing pig feed and 10 pounds of that bitchly cow corn. And in the bank, do I tell Mrs. Bollinger, oh, here's one big bastard of a check. Give me some of your Christing money. There, look there. See what you made me do. Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
James Caan stars as famous author of Victorian romance novels, Paul Sheldon, and his books feature a character named Misery Chastain. I almost said mystery, but it's I'm stuck on mist. Misery Chastain. While traveling from Colorado back home to New York, Sheldon is caught in a blizzard and his car crashes, leaving him unconscious. He wakes up in the home of Nurse Annie Wilkes, played with Optimal Crazy by Kathy Bates, who won an Oscar and a Golden Globe for this role. Annie reads his latest book and becomes enraged that he kills the main character. Therefore, she kidnaps him and forces him to write a new book, at one point even smashing his ankles to ensure he can't leave. In the original, and anybody who's ever dated crazy knows this is always a possibility. In the original novel,
yep.
Annie Wilkes severs one of Paul Sheldon's feet with an axe. Goldman loved the scene and argued for it to be included, but Rob Reiner, the director, insisted that it be changed so that she only breaks his ankles. Goldman subsequently wrote this was the correct decision as amputation would have been too severe. Rob Reiner also has a couple movies here, because he has Stand By Me as well, studied Alfred Hitchcock movies to figure out how to shoot a thriller, watching every Hitchcock film. Reiner had Hitchcock on the brain so much that James Caan overheard Reiner chastising himself on set one day, asking himself, "Who do you think you are, Alfred Hitchcock?" The answer is no, because he's the greatest director of all time. After refusing to speak about his motivations for writing Misery for 2 decades, Stephen King finally came out and stated that it is indeed about his battle with substance abuse. Kathy Bates' character is a representation of his dependency on drugs and what it did to his body, making him feel alone and separated from everything, while hobbling any attempts he made at escape.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that.
A lot deeper than people thought.
He did drugs?
Oh, yeah.
Whoa.
That's a whole other podcast. On Rotten Tomatoes, the film has an 89% rating based on 66 reviews and made $61 million domestic. Annie Wilkes was ranked number 17 on AFI's 100 Years, one of villains and heroes. So the top 100 heroes and villains list. Not too shabby. Now, those are my two picks, Misery and The Mist. Amanda, you keep, you're across from me and you keep shaking your head.
I hate The Mist. Like, I thought it was a terrible movie. It's not. I respect the ending and I like that choice, but everything else about the movie, aside from Andre Brower, I didn't realize he was, because I just recently watched this. This is one of the few movies that I hadn't seen that I needed to fix. And wow, I really wanted that movie to end. I was ready to go out and let the creatures take me. So I didn't like it at all.
As you can hear, we don't care about your opinion, and we want you to understand that The Mist is a great movie, and we're sorry you can't understand the greatness.
Okay, wrong.
Is it but above also, you? Is it just like you don't get it?
No, I get it. I get it fine.
I don't think you get it.
Also, just in case anybody's wondering.
It's a mist, and there are monsters in it.
The mist. Really, I love the concept.
But really, the monsters are in the grocery store.
I love the concept. Did not like the execution.
Did you like Stranger Things?
I haven't finished it. I'm still in season 1.
I guess it explains a lot then.
I love the concept.
What was that noise that John just made? Because I really wanted
that I'm so exasperated by the fact that she hasn't finished even being caught up with Stranger. Okay, she's got to go.
We have talked about this, Johnny.
You've had plenty of time to catch up since we talked about it last.
Oh,
anyway,
my gosh.
Go ahead.
Before we go on the cruise, I will watch it.
What's your vote?
Misery. Because Kathy Bates is spectacular, creeps me out, And the movie is well executed, unlike The Mist. And also, if you try to sue your neighbor for a tree falling on your house, your insurance company is going to tell you that is your responsibility because it fell on your house. Okay. Nobody else's insurance is going to cover that. So don't have a 50-minute conversation about it. Let it go.
You get hung up on some weird stuff. Troy, Troy, what is your pick?
Well, let me tell you, Misery is a movie. And Kathy Bates is amazing, just absolutely amazing in it. She just knocks it out of the park. But if Kathy Bates is not in that movie is boring as all get out.
Well, it's a good thing she's in this movie.
It is a giant snooze fest, and no one cares about stupid authors laying in a bed. Because when you have giant killer bees, spiders exploding other spiders, tentacle monsters, pterodactyls cracking in windows, all kinds of other amazing fun things going on, and then you add Frank's ending to the movie, The Mist is the best movie from a Stephen King adaptation that actually changes it enough that actually makes it 100 times better. So The Mist, all the way.
I bet you that screenplay probably looks great on paper.
You already had your say, all right? You shush. John, what's your vote? You decide.
Wow, this is really tough. No, it's not. The Mist.
Is that just in spite of Stranger Things?
No. Yes and no. The Mist is a wonderful, fun, scary, and intense movie. And the whole idea of these monsters that can, like, you don't really see very well and they just jump out. Yeah. All those things make it just a better movie. Then you got Thomas Jane, who, if it's got Thomas Jane in it, I'm going to usually try to side with him because I don't know what happened to his career. He should have had one. Aww. I don't know where it went. So anytime we have a chance to actually vote for Thomas Jane, I'll do it. And finally, Troy said it the best when it came to The Misery. Without Kathy Bates, that movie does not work.
Well, it's a good thing she's in the movie that we're discussing.
Well, it doesn't matter because The Mist moves on. Now we go to Ho South. John, you get him first. What are your two picks?
My very first movie I'm going to present to you, my favorite panel in the whole wide world, is The Green Mile.
I'm tired, boss. Tired of being on the road, lonely as a sparrow in the rain. I'm tired of never having me a buddy to be with, to tell me where we's going to, coming from, or why. Mostly I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. I'm tired of all the pain I feel and hear in the world every day. There's too much of it. It's like pieces of glass in my head all the time. Can you understand? Yes, John.
Released in the ripe old time of 1999, a scrappy writer-director looking to make a name for himself tackled this mountain of a movie. That scrappy writer-director is Frank Darabont. We have mentioned him before, but here he is again. Is this his first time tackling this sort of subject matter? No, it's actually his second time dealing with both Stephen King and a prison, because we're going to talk about that other one later. This time, there's magic, though, and arguably, because of that magic, it makes this movie better. It has a lot more heart. It has a lot more going for it. The film stars Tom Hanks, James Cromwell, Bonnie Hunt, and David Morse. All these people are titans in their own right. However, we're introduced to the lighter side of Michael Clark Duncan, who just showed us how much heart he can show and bring in a movie, and with this wonderful character that he played of Mr. Coffee. It also proved that even way back when, someone as unknown as Sam Rockwell can still make anything that he does a little better just by being him. The story of The Green Mile is one of hope. It touches the heart and it oozes magic, and that's why it's my first choice. Okay. My second choice is 2017's It.
Hiya, Georgie. What a nice boat. Do you want it back?
Yes, please.
You look like a nice boy. I bet you have a lot of friends.
Three, but my brother's my best ass.
Where is he?
In bed, sick.
I bet I could cheer him up. I'll give him a balloon. Do you want a balloon too, Georgie?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers.
Oh, well, I'm Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Pennywise? Yes, meet Georgie. Georgie, meet Pennywise. Now we aren't strangers, are we?
With even less credits to his name than Frank Darabont had, Andy Muschietti, what a great name for a director, was tasked with not only working with a Stephen King novel, but also bringing up something that is long loved and has already been done once before in a movie form, or actually a miniseries form, back in the 1990s. Actually helped draw a lot of ire from that wicked beast, the internet, that we all know about. It starred Tim Curry as the memorable Pennywise, and it was something that was just fascinating to watch and terrifying. So how does this movie fill those big ass clown shoes? Well, they found a way to take a story that we all know and love and still found a way to scare us. Complaints of the recasting did not actually hold any water because the cast was fascinating, fun, and scary to watch. This creative team managed to take a story that we all knew and found a new way to scare us. And it was executed in a way that taught people that we can actually remake these stories. And so with that, I'm going to go to Aaron. Which one of these two movies do you like the best?
Green Mile and It. It, I thought, was a great adaptation of the book. It was probably one of the best horror adaptations of any Stephen King novel. That said, The Green Mile is a movie I've watched over and over and over again, and it moves me every time I watch it. Sam Rockwell is fantastic. Michael Clark Duncan is fantastic. It almost feels like I'm there in that movie. It feels like I'm going through the same experiences that they are. And every time I put it on, I can't turn it off. Whereas It, I like it, but I just don't have the emotional connection. So I'm going to go with The Green Mile. Green Mile hits me a lot more than It does.
Okay. Troy?
That's a tough call for me because The Green Mile is everything that Aaron said that it is. The only problem is that It is like a fundamental Stephen King property, whether it's the book, whether it's the TV miniseries, whether it's this movie. And yes, technically it's only half of the movie because there's part two still coming out this year. But It had gotten so many things right in this, I guess you call it a remake of the miniseries, but it's its own movie in its own regard. I mean, it includes Maturin inside of there with a giant Lego turtle. So it pulls on some of the amazing things from the book. It has the orgy scene, if you will, without the orgy, but they get the concept of the orgy scene where they're all banding together to have their powers. Mm-hmm. And the way they leave the circle at the end of the movie is actually very significant when you tie it back to the book in particular. So where I think The Green Mile is a great movie and I enjoy watching it and I get the feels and everything from it and I love the little mouse, I think from a Stephen King perspective, I think It is a better movie because I enjoyed it. I saw a giant fat man throw a bucket of popcorn up in the air during the clown scene in the house. So when the popcorn bucket obstructs your view, I think you're in the right place. So I would have to go with It, unfortunately, over The Green Mile.
Well, it's no unfortunate. These are both great picks. I mean,
so I get to be the tiebreaker.
You get to decide.
Yay.
Yeah, because making decisions is what you love to do.
Right? She's so good at
I'm
it.
I'm excellent.
Did she pick two?
Yeah, right? Can I move them both to the next round? So I do love this version of It. I agree that it was creepy. The dialogue was amazing. It was super funny. But Green Mile is something that was so unique, and I like that it plays on stereotypes and social commentary, but also has a lot of heart in it. And we all know I'm a sap for some heart in my movies. I like to cry. Green Mile is something that stands up time after time that I want to go back and revisit. It is something that I don't mind revisiting, but I don't need to revisit. I'm going with Green Mile.
All right. Green Mile moves on. Troy, you get the last two to present before we move into the semifinals. So what are your two Stephen King adaptations?
Well, I am going to go with the one that's kind of started it all, first and foremost, and that is The Shining.
I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
You think maybe he should be taken to a doctor? When do you think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
Jack.
You believe his health might be at stake?
Yes.
You are concerned about him.
Yes.
And are you concerned about me?
Of course I am.
Of course you are.
Now, this movie is a series of mysteries that are all connected to each other. It's not a perfect movie. It's an amazing mystery. We'll put it that way. It's a great Stanley Kubrick film. It is not a Stephen King film. So just keep that for what it's worth.
You're like anti-selling us.
but no, it's a really great, amazing mystery. And I would have to argue with Aaron that The Mist is a good horror, but it's not really a horror. It's like an action. The Mist is an action flick with some, what do you want to call it? Cerebral context to it. I think that The Shining is a pure horror film. It blurs the line between sanity and insanity. And until the last act, there's actually two explanations of going on the entire time. Either he's going insane from cabin fever, or he's completely having a mental breakdown when he goes and attacks his family. And we don't even know what the hell's going on until you get to the very last part of it. You know, is he being corrupted by these evil spirits that inhabit the hotel? And when the truth is finally revealed in the last part of the movie, it's not even explained why the ghosts are doing what they're doing in the first place. Very little is answered, and you're left completely wondering why this all happened in the first place. And I think that's an amazing thing for the movie. I mean, it sticks, and it makes you wonder, and it makes you walk away and go, huh. And then you kind of watch it a couple more times. Plus, there's tons of the shout-outs and hidden messages from King properties in the movie. Fans have actually mapped out the entire maze and the layout of the mansion. They're basically trying to illustrate all of the theories that are out there. And the opening scene from the movie even features a certain car familiar to King fans. And, of course, you can't forget Room 237, because 237 is a very prominent number in Stephen King lore. Now, what I thought was fascinating, though, is that in tribute to the film, the makers of Toy Story actually made the carpet in Sid's house. If you look at the carpet, it's the same carpet from the carpet hallway scene in The Shining. And in fact, Lee Unkrich, who was part of Toy Story 3, the director, he actually runs a website dedicated to The Shining film.
Oh, wow. That's a fun fact.
I like this carpet thing. That's a fun fact.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Stephen King said that the title was inspired actually by John Lennon's Instant Karma, which actually features the line in the song, "We All Shine On," which is where the shining comes from. And Danny is one of the kids known to have the shine, this special psychic power to kind of see the other universes inside of the Dark Tower, kind of levels and mechanisms inside of the King universe. And Jake actually has the shine in the Dark Tower series, and they talk about Danny actually in the Dark Tower itself. So there's a lot of connections there. The heat that they actually generate from the lighting used to recreate the window sunlight inside of the hotel, the lounge set actually caught on fire and burnt down. And I pulled this one just for Aaron, because when that got rebuilt as part of the L Street Studios, that has actually got a higher ceiling now and was used as the snake-filled tomb in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Get out of here. That's cool. Yeah,
totally.
Something good came from that movie.
Oh, boy.
The Shining is also in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most retakes of a single scene, with 127 takes for the scene with Shelley Duvall.
Well, and do you want to narrow that down? I mean, she's in the movie a lot. Do you know which scene?
I can't remember which one it was in particular, but technically it took a lot to get that scene correct.
Okay.
With 127 takes. And the MPAA did not allow blood to be shown in any trailers that would be seen by all ages. And Kubrick persuaded them that the blood was rusty water and got the trailer passed.
Oh, wow.
That's funny.
Shining sits at 52 on IMDb's top 250 with a Metascore of 63. That is The Shining. My second movie is The Shawshank Redemption.
Emile Dufresne.
Wife-killing banker. Why'd you do it?
I didn't, since you ask.
You gonna fit right in. Everybody in here is innocent. Didn't you know that? Heywood, what you in here for?
Didn't do it.
Rumor has it you're a real cold fish. You think your shit smells sweeter than most. Is that right?
What do you think?
I'll tell you the truth. I hadn't made up my mind.
I understand you're a man that knows how to get things.
I'm known to locate certain things from time to time.
I wonder if you might get me a rock hammer.
A what?
A rock hammer.
Now, Shawshank is interesting because there is no way in hell this will lose to The Green Mile because stupid freaking Tom Hanks stole the Oscar from The Shawshank Redemption in the 1995 ceremony for films released in 1994. It was highway robbery that The Shawshank Redemption lost. I can understand why, because it was considered a box office flop, only bringing in $18 million for the $25 million budget. However, because of the Oscar nomination, that's when The Shawshank Redemption really began to shine. And then was picked up by Turner Classic and the Turner Corporation and has literally aired on cable almost every day since then on TNT, TBS, or the like. The Shawshank actually takes place over a 30-year period in the books, and it's only about 10 to 15 in the movie, where Andy Dufresne is a banker accountant, and he basically gets locked up in jail for a crime he didn't commit. He got framed for the crime, and he ends up meeting this guy named Red inside of Shawshank, where he becomes best friends with him, played by Morgan Freeman. Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman are just amazing in this movie. The things you learn in this movie are fantastic. The feels you get in this movie are fantastic. Everything about this movie is awesome. To this day, when The Marriage of Figaro plays anywhere, I cry because of that scene when they play the opera lady singing inside the yard because of Shawshank Redemption. In fact, the Shawshank Redemption is so prominent that people that are living in corporate America at their jobs for more than 10 years actually refer to their term at their companies as being Brooks'd, because they have been institutionalized in their jobs because they can't work anywhere else because they don't know how to do anything else. That's how iconic this has been. Waze, the app, actually had Morgan Freeman do voices for the Waze app. And when you had to turn left or turn right, it actually said, get busy turning or get busy dying.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Morgan Freeman's son also posed for the mugshot that you see when they stamp his papers to be paroled. Morgan Freeman himself, actually, when he pitches the baseball, when he meets Andy for the first time in the movie, Morgan Freeman actually threw that baseball for 9 hours straight.
No.
Literally dislocated his arm and had to wear a sling the next day.
Wow.
The sewer sludge inside of that 500 yards of bile and whatever else he had to crawl through, the length of 5 football fields, that was actually chocolate, if you can believe it. Chocolate, syrup, sawdust, and water. And even to this day, the pipes still smell like chocolate and cocoa today.
Oh, so that's cool. So if you're escaping, it smells delicious.
Exactly. We also have the number 237 showing up again here in the movie. For instance, it's the number on Red's cell specifically. And the digits are also Andy's prison ID number. And the number, of course, continues on, as I mentioned, in other places, including the room in The Shining. And the sound of the warden actually shooting himself is the same sound effect that they used for the man stamping approved on Red's parole paper.
Oh, wow. Cool facts, man. You're finding some cool, fun facts.
The other big thing that you want to know about this is that the TV show Castle Rock on Hulu, which aired last summer, actually was all based on a lot of the things that happened in Shawshank Redemption, to the fact that they actually had a scene where you got to see the warden's office, and the bullet hole is in exactly the same place in Castle Rock as it was from where the warden shot himself from the movie. So that was a cool little tie-in. The big thing, though, is that in 2015, the United States Library of Congress selected the film for preservation in the National Film Registry, finding it culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. And FYI, it is number one on the IMDb Top 250, beating out The Godfather in 2008 and holding that spot ever since. The other movies in that top five are, of course, The Dark Knight, Godfather 2, and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Wow.
Wait, Return of the King is the top Lord of the Rings one?
Return of the King is the top in the top five of the top 250 on IMDb.
Wow.
But most importantly, be excited that it was Raquel Welch in the movie, because in the book, the poster is actually Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah, that's a good change.
That would have been bad.
Yeah.
So regardless of what Peter Griffin from Family Guy says about the Raquel Welch poster, because I can completely debunk how you can tie that down and make it taut enough in order for the rock to go through.
No, you can't. It's a good theory. It's a good point.
Loops. It's tape loops. And you just use your fingers and pull. So mm-hmm. It's awesome.
I don't think that's how it works.
Anyways, we're going to go to Johnny first. to vote on whether or not Shawshank can clearly beat out The Shining.
Was there another movie that you mentioned besides Shawshank?
I don't think so. I mean, he said The Shining, but it didn't feel like he said The Shining. More like, I got words, Shawshank.
Right. All right. So it's not going to be very hard to discern where my vote's going to go. So let me just say, a few years ago, I finally sat down and watched The Shining because I had heard from so many people who love movies how amazing and fantastic that movie was. It's not. It's not at all. I didn't enjoy it. It wasn't a good time for me, and I want my money back. Somehow I own it too, so that's disappointing now. So that's why I'm going to say Shawshank.
Banda, let's go to you.
This may surprise you. Fun fact, The Shining is actually taught in almost every single one of my film classes that I've taken from both my associates and my bachelor's. Mm-hmm. So obviously, film professors and the people, the dean of film who creates this catalog of films that they feel we need to see, some of the best movies, a lot of which are Hitchcock. And The Shining. Shawshank was never in the lists. Sad times. That's where my vote goes, is Shawshank. Because, like, The Shining is good from a film.
Well, that took a turn.
Right?
Well, I was confused for a minute. I was like, holding on.
I kind of wanted you guys to think that I was going with The Shining for a second.
Oh, well, nice job.
I do like the movie. I don't hate it like you guys do. There's a lot of good potential in it. But the thing that bothers me the most about it is how much Stephen King did not like that adaptation.
It's one of the few movies of his that he actively admits he does not like.
Adamantly said that there was some parts that were creepy, but even down to Nicholson, that is not the person who is supposed to play the character, because you were supposed to wonder about his sanity and his
mania. Yeah, there's no debate. There's zero debate.
His grin is just something else. But I mean, I still like the movie for what it is, but as a Stephen King movie, I mean, that loses points there. And Shawshank is one of the best movies ever made.
All right. Well, I guess that leaves me. I hate The Shining.
Hate it?
Yep. I mean, those professors are dicks. I don't like them at all. And I don't think they should be teaching film history. It's one of those movies where everybody loves to argue with me and tell me how wrong I am. But let me tell you, I've watched it 4 times in my lifetime. 3 of them are because I wanted to reevaluate if I had changed my opinion over time, because the first time I saw it, I was a kid, and I saw it again in my 20s and 30s, and, you know, I'm obviously 31. Here's what I've come to surmise. I can't understand what people like about it. Yes, I agree 100% with Stephen King. It is not at all connected to his book. It's very different from his book. If you read his book, it's much more about alcoholism and addiction and losing oneself amongst that. This is more about man goes crazy at cabin. That's really what this movie is.
Right.
And the reason why I don't like it is probably the same reason everybody else loves it. I think Jack Nicholson sucks here. And sucks isn't a great. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing. I love Jack. He's one of my favorite actors of all time. Camp fever. The whole movie. Everybody else feels like they're in a scary ass horror movie, terrified of everything. And he looks like he is just cheesing out and having the campiest time ever. There's not the Here's Johnny moment. I laugh out loud every time I've ever seen it, because there's nothing scary about that. It's just ridiculous. It's him being campy, and it doesn't fit the movie. So I can't stand that movie. Shawshank, great movie. It's an easy vote for me. Like, I didn't even weigh it.
And his name's not even Johnny in the movie.
No.
It's dumb.
It's just a, hey, look at this connection to Johnny Carson. Ha-ha. Yeah, it's funny.
It's a great film. It's a horrible movie.
No, I think it's a bad film. I don't like The Shining at all. I just don't like it as a movie. Everybody always thinks it's just because of the adaptation point of it. It's not. I don't like it as a movie. Jack Nicholson, I feel like, is way too campy for that movie. And most people just hate on me left and right for it. But that is my opinion, and I'm going to stick to it.
Is there anything else in the movie that you don't like? You've mentioned Jack Nicholson and how it was adapted.
I am not a Kubrick fan. I feel like he drags things out and stretches them way too far. That happens in this movie. It's really more about Jack Nicholson's performance, though. That's my biggest problem with that movie. It just doesn't fit everything else that happens. There you go.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Shawshank was going on anyway.
It's true. So now we come to the semifinals. You don't have to give such detailed answers, but you can give a vote if you want. And we'll use the listener picks if we have to settle any ties. So let's go to Amanda first. You have Stand By Me versus The Mist.
Stand By Me.
Oh. Okay. That was easy. Now we go to John. John might be a little bit harder here, huh?
Well, both of these movies are great and fantastic, and they have their places in the annals of the canon of which we are discussing here. The Mist.
Okay. Now it's up to Troy. Troy, you're going between Stand By Me and The Mist.
Man, that's tough. That is super tough.
Well, you get a vote, too.
I know.
Oh, well, you said Troy gets to decide.
Oh, that's right. You don't get to decide, but you get a vote. You could decide. No, actually, no, you could decide. You couldn't, actually.
Because
it's 1-1 so far.
Yeah.
I can't count, man.
Aaron, I can't pick between those two. That's tough.
Well, you're going to have to at some point.
Amanda. You have to pick. Okay.
So the ending makes The Mist, right? If it wasn't for the ending, The Mist is not that great of a movie. Stand By Me is a good movie. You grow up on it. Everybody watches it. The puking scene is awesome. The leeches scene is awesome.
The leeches were real.
The leeches were real, yeah. So, gosh. But the ending is so good in The Mist.
But not the whole movie.
I disagree.
I gotta go to The Mist.
What?
What do I do?
Well, it's still not gonna win number one.
What do I do? The Mist versus... I can decide this, and I will. The Mist. I like The Mist so much more than Stand By Me. Oh, we've got our first surprise. Now let's go to the South and see what we got. The Mist moves on to the finals. We have
it's the cage fight.
Green Mile versus Shawshank Redemption. Let's start with John this time. What do you got?
This is a really tough call. It honestly is a tough call, but I'm gonna do what I don't do all that often, and I'm gonna vote for my movie just because it has magic, which is the Green Mile.
All right. Troy?
Well, Frank did both movies, and Frank wouldn't have been able to do the second movie without doing the first movie first. And the fact that it's like number one by everybody's regard in the world, pretty much, Shawshank has to go ahead of the Green Mile because it's not losing to freaking Tom Hanks again.
Yeah, I don't care what IMDb says. Amanda?
Shawshank!
Ooh, well, I'm going with Green Mile.
Well, what are the listeners going
with?
We
have a tie. Yes, we do. And I'm with John. It has nothing to do with it being your movie. I just think The Green Mile is a better movie than Shawshank Redemption.
You're high.
Mm-hmm. No, I get so much emotion from Green Mile, man.
I get so much emotion from Shawshank. The N, the letter, the island. Come on.
None of that hits me as hard as I'm just so tired of this world, boss. I'm just tired.
Yeah.
People being mean to each other. I'm just tired. I'm going to watch The Green Mile. This is done. All right. So now we move on to the listeners, because we have to decide for this one, because we have a tie. We have Green Mile versus Shawshank. The listeners have, well, it's not close. The Shawshank Redemption is beating the Green Mile. Well, actually, it is kind of close. It's number, yeah. So Shawshank moves on.
Yeah, yeah.
So now we have, honestly, to me, it's an easier one. The Mist versus Shawshank Redemption. And I think, Troy, you get to go first this time.
I think at this point, do we have to go based on... like closest adaptation to the works, or just straight on the movie?
It doesn't change anything. It is the best movie.
How we've been voting all along.
Yeah, it's how we've been voting all along. So whatever you, it's your vote. Whatever you think is the best Stephen King movie, go. Of those two, The Mist versus Shawshank.
And that's two Franks again.
Mm-hmm, Frank, I called it early.
It's same logic applies. He doesn't get to do the others unless he gets Shawshank first. So Shawshank gets my vote.
It's a weird way to vote, but okay.
Even though the ending is really good.
I'm going to go next because I've been going last, I think. So The Mist by a mile, actually. I enjoy The Mist so much more.
That's a close vote. That's not easy, even though you think it is. It's not easy.
I enjoy the entire movie, not just the ending, the entire movie. I love it. Amanda?
Shawshank.
John?
I am going to have to go with the one that I've seen the most. Because I love The Mist, and I think it's a fantastic movie, but I keep on, I'll rewatch Shawshank any given chance.
This is just,
what up, midges?
I feel like we just wasted an hour.
I feel like we just wasted. Can I just say, I find Shawshank to be a great movie, but can you overrate a movie that is great? Because I feel like it's still overrated, even though I do love it. You know what I mean?
I just think it's overrated.
Number one movie out of 250. Are you kidding
Somebody's got to be number one.
But Shawshank Redemption, I wouldn't even put it in my top 20 of all time.
Well, the
overrated is the wrong term to call it. Maybe you're just so tired of seeing it every single time you go past TBS.
That's possible.
They did a lot of Green Mile, though. They used to do a lot of Green Mile.
Green Mile because it's a better movie.
It's long and it's
second of it is enjoyable. Where Shawshank, I'm like, God, is he out of prison yet? No, Shawshank's a great movie. I don't want to put Shawshank down. Okay, now listener top three from 3 to 1. It was number 3.
Wow.
I'm actually surprised it's
of
that
2017.
High. Yeah, 2017. We kept TV movies out of it for damn good reason. Number 2 is The Green Mile, and number 1 is The Shawshank Redemption. So it feels like the right movie came out ahead.
So even if Johnny hadn't picked Shawshank and went with The Mist, it would have been 2-2 again, and we would have deferred to listener comments.
But I think it
still would have won.
Fantastic that The Mist came out in the final two.
Don't. I think we have some incorrect thought processes going on here.
Now, here, I got one more question before we close the show out. Okay, guys, ready?
It's not on the format.
It's not on the format, but I told you all about this earlier, so it's your fault if you didn't pay attention.
I hope I read the message.
What is your personal favorite Stephen King adaptation? Whatever your favorite Stephen King movie is. And yes, you pick one. Troy?
100%. It's The Dreamcatcher. I love it. I watch it every time it comes on. Just to see Morgan Freeman
Even Morgan Freeman says, I hate that movie. With his eyebrows.
His freaking eyebrows, man. They're like giant caterpillars on his face.
Ah, my eyebrows are coming for you. They're the dream catcher.
No, honestly, my favorite adaptation, like the most faithful, is Stand By Me by far. I love Shawshank as a movie, but from King's work perspective, I think Stand By Me is by far the best. I would really love to see Frank Darabont, honestly, though, like really tackle Because of the Mist, and it has the same kind of concepts as Under the Dome. I'd love to see an Under the Dome movie done the right way with Frank at the helm. I think that would be fantastic.
That could be better. Yeah, it could be better.
But yeah, Stand By Me.
John, what's your favorite Stephen King adaptation?
You're going to think that I'm trying to be funny.
Okay.
But it honestly is Dreamcatcher.
Is it really?
Are you trying to be funny?
I don't know.
No, I am actually not trying to be funny. I
don't know for the poop scenes.
I don't know why I love watching that movie so much. I like watching the all the guys getting together, and I love how every one of them have their little magic trick that they can do, and like Thomas Jane talking into the gun like it's a phone because Jonesy is calling him, and you know, I just like, I really like it, and it makes me smile every single time I watch it. I'm not being funny, I swear to God.
Okay, I respect if that's your pick.
You know, it's number 25 on the list of most popular Stephen King movies. Like 25. Cell beats Dreamcatcher.
Hey, you know what? Whatever makes John happy.
You know what? No, that's what I was going to say next. I respect that you have such a bold decision here.
I am sending you a Christmas present with an I Done It's t-shirt now.
I Done It's. Oh my God. Don't.
I Done It's.
Don't
tease me.
Yeah.
I Done It. Amanda, what's your
favorite? I will wear the shit out of that t-shirt.
He'll wear it to Christmas dinner. He'll wear it to birthdays, parties. He don't care. I Done It.
He looks like Done It.
One worm, ill world.
Amanda, what's your favorite?
Shawshank.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do really love Stand By Me, and Troy had a really good point with it. And I'm actually reading The Body right now. But when
it's very close.
When I first bought it, I had no idea that was what I figured the book had the same name, but they had to change it because they said it sounded kind of creepy.
The funny thing is that you're still reading it. It's like 80 pages in a PDF. You can do it in like an hour.
No, I didn't start reading it when I bought it. I just picked it up because I have this problem whenever I go past the book aisle at my local store. I buy a book that I don't need to buy. And I saw that one. I was like, oh, that's a really cool cover. I like that. And it's Stephen King. I'm going to give it a shot.
Four Seasons? Or is it actually in a novella? It's like in a pamphlet form.
It's like a paperback book.
Well, that's a small paperback because that's a short book.
Yeah. It's,
okay.
About that thick.
Big letters.
She said it's about that thick for the radio.
The huge font.
What is that, like an inch and a half? An inch?
It's radio. Nobody can see your fingers. I'm asking you. Yeah, that looks like an inch. That's what I tell my girlfriends.
Your wife will be so pleased to hear that.
All right, so
she doesn't listen to the podcast.
That's true. My favorite is, and I'm not trying to make a joke, it's Stephen King's Silver Bullet. I don't know if you guys were.
Ooh, yeah.
Good call.
That's my favorite.
I actually just rewatched that 3 weeks ago.
Did you really?
It's on Amazon Prime. I sat down and I watched that.
Man, I watch it at least once a year. I'm not kidding. At least once a year.
I saw it for
that the first. That has the fine distinction of having one of the second best werewolves ever put the film.
I'm telling you. And the ending is intense, even though it looks like shit now, but it's still really intense, really intense. Just.
I can't feel my legs.
I saw it for the first time. What was it, like 2 Halloweens ago, 2 or 3, something like that. And when I first started watching it, I was like, there's no way this is going to be a good movie. Like, I thought it was going to be really cheesy and over the top, but I actually really liked it. And it's totally your kind of movie, Aaron, because you love werewolves.
I do.
Love them.
Let's play Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew chase down the fucking werewolf. Gary Busey's great in that movie.
There is a really, I like, there's one scene stands out to me. They go into like this, what is it, like a barn or something? He chases, it goes into the barn with him. And that was a cool scene. I liked that.
Yeah. It's an intense movie. And that's going to do it, guys. Thank you for listening. This has been The Hollywood Outsider. And I hope you enjoyed this fully Stephen King-ized episode. And we'll see you next week. Remember, you can find everything you need to find at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Make sure you subscribe. Tune in. We'll be back next week. Thank you. And remember, the next time you head to a theater or stream Stephen King comfortably on your couch, buy popcorn.